Einsteigen, aufdrehen, losfahren. Mit dem neuen Volkswagen T-Roc bist du bereit für den großen Auftritt. Selbstbewusst und voller Power. Du steigst ein? Keine Kompromisse. Nur du und der Moment. Alles passt. Dein Sound, dein Drive, dein T-Roc. Rockt. Der neue T-Roc.
The Axe of the Blood God.
Welcome to another episode of Axe of the Blood God, US Gamer's official RPG podcast. I'm your host, Kat Bailey. With me, as always, is my lovely co-host, Nadia Oxford.
Howdy, how's it going?
And as always, way to sound really excited there, Nadia. Jeez, are you okay over there?
Yeah, it's just a really cloudy, bled day over here.
Oh my gosh, well, I hope you feel better soon. I mean, talking about RPGs always kind of like winds me up a little bit. So
it does cheer me up, so I'm glad for this.
Like, I'll be feeling kind of like, too much work. And then the next thing I know, I'm like, RPGs. And as always, we talk about RPGs, big and small, Western, Eastern. We love them very, very much. And this week, we're going to be talking about a surfeit of RPG news. We have the next RPG from the Tokyo RPG Factory, a game whose name I can't even pronounce.
I've been calling it Lost Sphere, even though it's probably something like Lost Pear. Oh, no, I lost my pear. Mom!
And we will be comparing it to their previous effort, which was that one game that's name I can't...
I am Setsuna.
It made such an impression on me that I can barely remember its name. But Nadia has some thoughts on that. We'll talk a little bit about Indivisible coming out on the Nintendo Switch. I am actually pretty excited about this one, Nadia. It's looking real gorgeous. And We'll talk about Monster Hunter XX also coming out on the Switch, which I contend is actually a very big deal. And If it comes out along with Pokemon, we will be in real good shape.
Yeah, we'll be in really good shape. Holy moly. And especially if we get like a, I don't know when Persona update would be coming to the Switch, if at all, but probably
Persona
not
Persona 5 Crimson.
What's that?
Persona 5 Crimson.
Persona 5 Crimson and Black.
I would give it 2 years.
Okay, so Monster Hunter first.
Depends on whether or not it actually turns out to be, you know, like... Depends on whether the Switch can keep up its momentum. I'm sure that Atlas is already looking at it. Because they always do this. Like, they did it with Persona 3. They released Persona 3 Fez. And then Persona 3 Portable. And then Persona 4, of course, got Persona 4 Golden. Though it didn't get a... It did not get a second version on the PS2. It got ported to the Vita. And it took a couple years to eventually make it over to the Vita. Or no, like 4 years. Four or five years. Yeah, it didn't come out until like 2012. So we'll have to wait a little bit on that one. So I don't know, Persona 5 Crimson in like 2 years. But yeah, we're not going to be talking about Persona this week. Or Chrono Trigger, I'm sorry.
Probably next week, though.
I'm failed. I am fail. I'm bowing. I'm bowing in, like, contriteness. I have been kind of playing a lot of Heroes of the Storm the past week, and that's been taking up most of my efforts. Yes, a stupid MOBA is taking up all of my RPG time. That could be better spent playing, say, Persona 5 or Chrono Trigger. But you know what? Like, sometimes when you're not reviewing a game, you just need to sit back and relax and play a game that you actually want to play.
Yeah.
As opposed to playing the games that you feel obligated to play. And for me, that has been going online and playing some Heroes of the Storm.
Yeah, you deserve to unwind, Kat.
Yeah, playing RPGs is unwinding for me, usually. But I don't know, like, Persona 5, it feels like kind of like a commitment right now for me.
Well, it is a bit of a commitment. I mean, it's a good commitment, but God, I'm like 70 hours in and I'm on like November.
Oh my God. See, you're so far. I feel so ashamed. Like, you're so far ahead.
Well, this we're going to switch roles for the Persona report.
I guess so. I mean, I suppose this summer, like, we could probably do a Persona 5 postmortem, one of those postmortems that we've always been promising. Because, I mean, I got you, I got Katie, and then I got a friend of mine, Steve, who's been on the show before, who, oh my gosh, he has some fiery takes about Persona 5.
Really?
He's not a fan.
Not a fan, really? Now, that's just weird to me, because I just love it.
You're loving it.
Yeah.
Yeah,
and
you're loving
Katie
it.
Katie loved it.
Katie loved it, but... Persona 5 is coming out on the Switch eventually, maybe, we hope.
Someday.
But one game that has been confirmed for the Switch is Indivisible. Have you heard of this one, Nadia?
I've heard of it, but you're going to have to tell me more about it.
Sure, and I will tell the audience about it too. Indivisible is an indie game by the people who did Skullgirls. Skullgirls, of course, is a fighting game that has a really nice anime graphics. It's mostly best known for being really attractive, very like having really nice hand-drawn graphics.
I think I know this game. Was it on Kickstarter?
Are we talking about Indivisible or are we talking about Skullgirls?
No, Skullgirls, no, Indivisible.
Indivisible was on Indiegogo.
Okay, I think I might have backed it or something. Because I seem to remember the graphics, and they were just really gorgeous, and he had these really interesting character designs, and I thought it looked really cool.
Yeah. No, I was the same way. So it's like basically my dream game, okay? Mm-hmm. Because not only is it a handsomely drawn RPG by the creators of Skullgirl. And let's be honest, okay? Like, I really wanted to like Skullgirls, but I don't like fighting games anymore.
Yeah, there's that.
Fighting games have been ruined for me.
Why have they been ruined?
Okay, back in 1992, fighting games were my favorite genre, probably. Like I loved Street Fighter. It was probably a top five game for me. Mm-hmm. I adored Street Fighter. Like if I could have played Street Fighter into the ground, I would have. It was just such a novel, beautiful experience for me.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And over the years, like, I continued to enjoy it. I really enjoyed Alpha 3. I played a lot of Marvel vs. Like, my girlfriend and I, when we first started dating, we bonded over Soul Calibur and Marvel vs. Capcom 2. This was back when I could enjoy fighting games just as a casual scrub noob, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And now, every time I try to play a little fighting game, I run into some jerk who like is way better than me, and it's like and if I like complain about it, then I get like the fighting game community down in my grill going, well, you know, get good, you should be studying all of the videos by Combo Fiend, and what's your problem, etc., etc., etc. Like, it's turned fighting games into an environment that I find not fun, because it just feels beyond my level. Like I'm not allowed to enjoy fighting games unless I can play at like a high level, and I find that incredibly frustrating.
Yeah, I can actually relate to you, because I was someone who also played like Street Fighter 2 down to the ground, and there was one summer I had surgery and I couldn't do much of anything, and I played the hell out of Super Street Fighter 2 on the Super Nintendo. And I'm one of those idiots who are like really into like the lore and the character backgrounds and stuff like that. So when Street Fighter V came out with like no story background or anything to really, you know, get me interested in the characters or what they were doing, I kind of lost interest. And I know they've built up the game since then, but I haven't really felt the compulsion to go back to it. And yeah, and of course that whole like toxic community, and I haven't really wanted to get into
that. It's not even the toxic community. It's the fact that, I mean, it's a mental block for me. Like, when I play Street Fighter now, I feel like I'm playing it wrong.
Yeah, okay.
I feel like I'm, like, going, I am playing this badly. I am not doing it right. Why?
Yeah.
Like, I am physically incapable of doing the stuff that other people, like, I should be doing. Like, I am not, I cannot play at the level that is required for this game. Why am I even playing this game? This is a total waste of time.
No,
I should just stop right now.
Yeah, no,
and
you're
even
right.
When I beat my friends, I'm like, congratulations, you suck just as much as I do. That is the mindset that I take into these games. So it's not entirely the internet's fault that these games have been ruined for me, but I think it's a combination of factors. So as a result, I never got into Skullgirls.
Okay, yeah. Long story short, you're
bringing
not into
it back around. I never got into Skullgirls, okay?
Yeah.
Well, Indivisible, I mean, now it's an RPG. I can square with that.
Mm-hmm,
and not only
too.
That, it's like Valkyrie Profile.
Oh,
it's
boy.
Basically Valkyrie Profile again, but with like gorgeous anime characters. I mean, hello.
When's it coming out?
Next year.
Yeah. Put that one on my calendar.
2018. Throw that one on the pile, but man, I am really looking forward to playing Indivisible. Like, what they've shown so far, like, you're kind of like a Sailor Moon-esque schoolgirl type character, and you're, I mean, maybe not Sailor Moon, maybe you're just kind of a schoolgirl, but you have, like, various anime type tropes following you around in your party. You have tons of characters to recruit. Really nice backgrounds. It's animated by like a actually pretty well-known anime artist. Has done stuff like Kill la Kill and that kind of thing. And when you're in the battles, it's like Valkyrie Profile, where like you are doing the dial-a combos and that kind of thing with your party. Because like,
I love that term.
As you may recall, like in Valkyrie Profile, like one character is mapped to square, another is mapped to triangles, circle, X, that kind of thing. And the way that you have them attack and build up their meter is like kind of the strategy of it. And it can be a little one-dimensional at times, but it makes for a cool effect.
Yeah, so, now that you mentioned what it is, I know the game. It's just, it was one of those games where I looked at it and I said, wow, that looks really cool. I want that. And then, like, of course, since it's in development, you kind of forget about it for a long time. Then it comes back to the surface. It's like, wow, that this exists. The world's a good place again.
I love that this game is on the Switch. I love that these kinds of games are making it to the Switch. I think that the Switch is the kind of environment where they will flourish.
Yes.
So, yeah, more like this, please.
Yeah, absolutely. I will buy them.
And, I mean, if I were going to play this game on anything, it would be the Nintendo Switch, because it is a kind of game that I would like to play in kind of a more of a handheld portable environment.
Yeah, I've really
with a cup of tea.
Yeah. With a cup of tea, yes, of course. I've really been spoiled.
Because I'm a proper British lady.
Do you have any British descent in you?
No, I don't, actually. I have Irish.
Oh, so do I. So. Well, Irish like their tea.
Catherine Bailey.
Kate, oh, yeah. Rich.
Yeah, exactly. I apologize to any British listeners and also to my cohorts at Eurogamer for that terrible, terrible accent. I don't even know what was going on there. But I digress. Another game that's coming out from the Nintendo Switch, Monster Hunter XX.
Yes.
Yes, which will be a port. It's not being made specifically. An upgraded port. If I recall correctly, this happened with the Wii U. So Monster Hunter 4, 3? One of the two.
I think it was 4.
I think it was 3.
Maybe.
I digress. Yeah. It was an upgraded port for the Wii U. And you could play it on both the 3DS or the Wii U. And some people preferred the Wii U version. But the thing with the Wii U version was that...
You had to have a Wii U.
I mean, you had to have a Wii U version. And, of course, the Wii U did not have a good install base. So not a lot of people bought it. Like, people favored the 3DS version. And as a consequence, it never really took off, I don't think. And then when Monster Hunter, the next Monster Hunter came out, it really kind of took off in the U.S. in a way that the series had never really taken off to that point. A lot of that was down to the fact that previously it had been on the PSP, and the PSP, while it has a dedicated fan base and tons of great RPGs, don't get me wrong, I loved my PSP in the day. On the other hand, all of my PSP games were imports.
Except and my battery fell out somewhere. I have no
except
idea
for maybe like Final Fantasy VII Crisis Core.
That was a great game.
But yeah, all the rest of my games were imports because it had a great import scene. But yeah, the Monster Hunter games were coming out here and nobody bought them. Because PSP was such a, it became a niche thing. And
yeah, it did.
Like, you can yell at me for saying that, but that's
it's true, though.
That's the truth. So, and then, of course, Monster Hunter came onto the 3DS, which was a much more mainstream system, and lo and behold, like, it became much more of a popular thing.
Yeah,
of course,
not quite as big
was,
as Japan, but yeah, it was still a lot bigger.
It's a damn sensation over in Japan.
Yeah.
It has been. It's one of the few games that can consistently sell well north of a million copies. Over in Japan. When you see a game that is selling much more than a million copies, you know that is a very successful game. Because a successful game over there is a few hundred thousand copies.
Wow.
That is how small the traditional console market has gotten over there.
That is so sad.
Yeah, it kind of breaks my heart a little bit.
Aww.
But Monster Hunter XX, I think on the Switch, kind of a perfect storm, right? Switch has been successful so far over in Japan, much as it has over here. And it combines all of the things that we're kind of looking for in the series. Like, it's portable. So it goes, it will go over well with Japan in that regard. The thing that I always found really interesting was the peer pressure to play Monster Hunter over there.
Play or not, one of the cool kids, Kat.
I mean, not just in school, but with work.
Oh, really?
Like, your coworkers would go out after work and play Monster Hunter together. Oh. And you would see packs of people, like school kids in particular, with PSPs all playing Monster Hunter at the mall, over at McDonald's, the whole, the works after school. Like, that's how people socialized, right?
Over their, like, monsters. Like,
you're hanging out, you're fighting monsters, you're grinding, whatever. And it's much like playing Overwatch here or something like that.
Right.
Getting together a group of friends and playing some Overwatch on your computer. But so, yeah, that social aspect is very important over in Japan, because online, it's, I mean, it's a little bit of a thing, but it's not the same as over here. Like, people are still doing the kind of the get-togethers, as it were. So having that mobile aspect, very important. And over here, like, I mean, it's going to be a, on the one hand, you can be playing with your friends in a kind of group get-together, say at PAX, and, or like bring it over to your friend's house or something like that. That will be awesome. Yeah. I have a couple of friends who are really into Monster Hunter. I could totally see myself playing with them. I've never really gotten into it to this point because I've always been kind of like, it's kind of a grind. I don't know.
I've always been wanting to. Like, I really did mean to play the latest 3DS version, but I just never got around to it because it came out at a weird time, and I couldn't get to it. But so I would definitely be up to giving, is it XX, double X, triple X, a try.
I'm just going to go with XX.
XX.
Yeah. 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 Double Monster Hunt or Monster Hunter 20. I don't know.
20.
Yeah, no, it's going to be Monster Hunter XX. I don't think Monster Hunter X ever came out here.
I never heard of it.
The previous Monster Hunter. Yeah, no, it never came out here. It's just going to go straight to the Switch, I guess.
Mm-hmm. I remember there was a mobile version that people got so pissed off because it broke. Like, it was a, I think it was a port of the PS, one of the PSP games, and it just broke. So many of Capcom's games broke on mobile once iOS 8 came around. And Capcom didn't fix it for ages and ages. And this was a game you paid a lot of money for. It wasn't a free-to-play game. Mm-hmm. So, actually, a lot of Capcom's games back in the day were expensive, and you paid for them, and then they broke, and they never fixed them. So that was a festival.
I've always argued that Monster Hunter never really took off here in the U.S. because it wasn't on, like, one of the major consoles like PS3, PS4. You'll notice that Persona 5 managed to enter into the public eye in a really significant way because it was on the PlayStation 4, as compared to some of the previous games, which were on older consoles.
Yeah.
The Switch is a major console in the way that the Wii U simply was not. The Wii U was not, the Wii U was written off almost as soon as it came out.
Pretty much. Poor Wii U.
Once again, it has its fans, but it just, like, there was a sense of malaise around that console as soon as it came out that does not exist around the Switch. People love the Switch. I love the Switch. There are reasons to love the Switch.
I can fully acknowledge that it's half-baked in many regards. Like, we don't have any sort of virtual console. We don't have, like, any sort of online interface. But I still love the stupid thing.
More at E3. Yeah. No, absolutely. It's not going to, like, even begin to reach its full potential until, like, next year.
Yeah. Right?
I mean, we're not going to get, like, major features into the fall.
Yeah, you're right.
Major features.
And Nintendo, they took that gamble, and fortunate for them, it paid off.
Yeah, well, good for them, right?
Yeah.
Congratulations on being able to sell a half-baked piece of hardware.
Only Nintendo can do it.
With a generationally great game.
Yep, pretty much. But there's a lot of great games on the Switch. I've been playing Puyo Puyo Tetris. It's a lot of fun.
Okay, yeah. Spectre of Torment, that kind of thing. But actually, there aren't a lot of great games on it. We got Mario Kart, and we've got Zelda, and we've got... Yeah, I've got a friend who bought a Switch, but has not bought any games for it yet because he already finished Breath of the Wild on the Wii U, so he doesn't really feel a reason to get that one. And he's like, Mario Kart 8, I don't know. I've already played that one. Don't necessarily need it. And so I'm like, Spectre of Torment?
There's a lot of fun little games on there. Like, just give them a try, and not too expensive.
No, he's saying that he feels good about himself because he hasn't been forcing himself to buy games that he's not excited about just to be able to play them on this new console that he has.
I guess that's fair. Yeah.
On the other hand, he's a sucker because he just flew across the country with a Switch that has no games on it.
What'd he do with it? Like, use it to hold his drink?
I mean, he brought it with him. Maybe he just thought he was going to pick up a game like while he was here, but I don't know. Like, come on, dude. Get a game for it. I don't even know what's going on.
Did he take it like a trophy wife? This is my Switch.
Yeah, but yeah, no. So, and so Monster Hunter, like I said, hits that sweet spot with being more of a handheld experience, but also it's going to be on the TV. It's going to be on console. You're going to be able to play it with your friends, right?
Yeah.
That's exciting.
The last time I played Monster Hunter was actually on TV. I played the Wii version. Was that three?
Oh, yeah, yeah. You played the Wii version. Okay.
Yeah. I didn't play it as much as I should have. Because you know why? Because I picked up, shortly afterwards, I picked up Xenoblade, which was just an excellent, excellent game. And going back to Monster Hunter 3's kind of like segmented world felt a little weird. So, yeah.
Well, hopefully hopefully Nintendo rolls out like a significantly greater suite of online options before Monster Hunter XX comes out.
Yeah, there was the fact that the Wii's online was terrible.
I mean, I don't think they have voice chat at the moment, for example. Or, like, really a lot of things. You can just play over Skype or whatever. Like, you can get on Skype.
Oh, like, boy, just what I want to do.
What I would do is I would get on Skype on my phone with, like, my, like, headphone or whatever and just chat with my friend while playing a game. But I don't know. Like,
not really something like, I want to do.
In-game voice chat would be nice.
Yeah.
Some kind of like party finder, like matchmaking, that kind of thing would be really nice for a game like Monster Hunter on the Switch. So there are barriers to properly enjoying it on the TV. On the flip side, Monster Hunter 4, if I recall correctly, was a really good-looking game on the 3DS. Mm-hmm. And I'm really excited to be playing that on my big TV.
Yeah, I can deal with that. I remember it was a beautiful-looking game, and it was, again, it was a game I really wanted to play, but I never got around to.
Yeah, I'm going to get some scale, nice sense of scale for the Switch and that kind of thing. So, in any case, so yeah, Monster Hunter XX, I called it one of the two major killer apps for the Nintendo Switch, along with Pokemon, because these were two games that had never really gained traction on console before. Pokemon, because it had never had a proper release on a console. Pokemon Coliseum does not count. I'm sorry.
Heresy.
And Monster Hunter had been kind of a non-starter on console going back to the PlayStation 2 days. It had always been really successful on the Vita, so, or on the PSP. So, and the fact that both of these games are probably coming out, I mean, Stars like has not been confirmed yet. But I wouldn't be surprised if it announced during the Nintendo Direct.
It's not a matter of if, it's a matter of when with Stars. I mean, they even have that whole marketing campaign, Look to the Stars, which I wrote about a few weeks ago, and has some really beautiful merchandise. And I was like, oh no, all of my money, where did it go?
I mean, if they don't release it this year, it's going to be like not coming out anytime soon. So,
but I don't see that until
No, there would be no Pokemon this year, which would be kind of a drag. But on the other hand, that would give them something big to push in 2018. So I don't know.
That's true. We'll find out soon enough.
Yes, we will. Okay. One more piece of RPG news. Tokyo RPG Factory has announced their next game in the series. It doesn't actually look that different from I Am Setsuna, which was their first game. Nadia, you wrote a little bit about how their new game can learn from I Am Setsuna, so I'm going to kind of let you take the lead on this one.
Well, last time we talked about I Am Setsuna on this podcast, I think Jason Schreier was with us, and at the time I was not too far into the game, and it's not that I hate the game by any means. I think it had a lot of potential, and I'm still really glad that Tokyo RPG Factory exists and is doing these types of games. But overall, there was something about that game that kept me from getting totally engaged in it, and it's just weird. Like all these little barriers of entry, it keeps stopping me from really getting involved. Like for one thing, I guess it's one of those games where as you play it, you start off thinking, wow, this looks really nice. Wow, this sounds really nice. And then you realize, wow, this is the same thing over and over and over again. They just kind of copy-pasted everything. The wintry setting, again, was beautiful at first, but like real winter, it wears on you. The piano tunes were beautiful, but then you realize, oh, okay, I guess all we're getting is a piano. All right. And one of the biggest flaws, I think, is how the combat system is so one-to-one, like Chrono Trigger's. And that's, I Am Setsuna, like, even if it was better than it is, matching up to Chrono Trigger is a hell of a job, because it is such an incredible RPG. I mean, Kat, you know that firsthand. So I think they're really kind of discounting themselves by trying to be so, by trying so hard to be like Chrono Trigger. I feel like they should have maybe even like a more traditional battle system, like gone with that instead. Just, you know, something that tells me, okay, this is a traditional RPG, that's fine, but don't remind me of Chrono Trigger, because I'm going to be comparing you to Chrono Trigger. And you don't want that.
I mean, it wasn't a horrible idea to bring back, like, say, the battle system and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
You wrote in your What It Can Learn from I Am Setsuna, I Am Setsuna's main character is as blank as a white sheet after a laundry day.
Yeah, that sounds like something I'd write. Yes. The comparison I made, and I think is really, really apt, Archive of Our Own is, of course, a fan fiction archive of, like, adult fan fiction, or regular fan fiction as well, just stuff oriented around fandom. And people will make fan fiction out of anything, and there is nothing about I Am Setsuna, which goes to show how bland and boring its characters are. That's just really detrimental.
Didn't you say that there was some, like, really obscure thing having, like, 1,200 fanfics or something like that?
There's Lazy Town. It's, like, I don't know if it counts as obscure anymore, but it just has, you know, that it's the show with, like, Sportacus and Robbie Rotten, and it's,
I have never heard of
Lazy Town. You never heard of it? You
know,
it
no.
I know it became a meme at some point, but it's basically, like, it's huge in the yaoi community because people like to ship Sportacus and Robbie Rotten. And, I mean, okay. I have a really good friend who writes for a living, and she's really good, and she writes fan fiction about Robbie Rotten and Sportacus.
Okay.
But the point is, yes, this fandom has, like, 1,200 fan fictions and more added every day, and Ender, I love his design. I think it's really compelling. But he's just, like, a really boring character. He doesn't do anything. He doesn't say anything.
He's rather cold and detached from his fellow party members.
Yes, exactly.
And Chrono was a silent protagonist, but he was very expressive.
Yes, exactly. Even, like, those simple sprites, you could kind of convey. Like, don't get me wrong, he wasn't, like, Shakespearean or anything like that, but Chrono has, you know, a certain sense of justice to him. Like, I mean, there's that whole bit with the, you know, that happens at the Ocean Palace. I won't say what happens, even though you probably know it very well by now. He's just a really likable character. And the same thing with Link. I mean, Link in, like, A Link to the Past, of course, he's kind of blank, and the same in the original Zelda as well, but by Skyward Sword, like, he was emoting quite well. He emotes in Breath of the Wild. He doesn't talk, but he doesn't really need to.
No, I mean, like, Breath of the Wild was a very emotive game, especially during the cutscenes.
Exactly.
God, I love the flashbacks in that game. No, the voice acting isn't super great, but I liked learning about Link's kind of fraught relationship with Zelda, like, piece by piece. And then, like, his relationship to the various characters and everything, and, like, how they were going to deal with the impending doom and all that. Like,
yeah,
I really wanted to learn about it because the game was dishing it out in kind of small doses. And there was an emotional core there. Zelda's frustration with Link because Link was totally overshadowing her. He's like, I don't need you, hero. Go away. God, he's doing something awesome again. Damn it.
Yeah, the relationship is kind of cute, I have to say. You know what? I don't find Zelda's voice acting all that bad in Breath of the Wild. It's not terrible. I don't know. I can kind of get the feeling that she's just, like, really worn out and weary of the whole thing, and I can't blame her for that.
Oh, Link. Okay. You said, I Am Setsuna's cooking feature is cold and unappetizing.
Yeah, because it's, like, one of the comparisons I made was to Odin Sphere, which, of course, has these, like, really big, delicious-looking dishes. You don't see anything at all like that in I Am Setsuna. And this is a game where, you know, there's a lot of potential to have, like, fun little dishes. Like, it's a winter game. I mean, Kat, you lived in a winter environment. You know how... You lived in Michigan, right?
No, I lived in Minnesota.
Minnesota. It's an M. It's an M. It's cold. What do you want from me?
Come on, Nadia. They're very different states. Okay.
Does
Minnesota... One had Michael Moore come from it. I mean...
Oh, shit. That's right. Yes. Does Minnesota have a lot of, like, coffee shops and stuff like that?
It does, yes.
Okay, because that's one thing a friend of mine from the southern states, from Texas, came up to Canada, Toronto, and he's like, you guys have so many friggin' coffee shops here. And they're all, like, and they don't just serve coffee. They serve, like, you know, soup and stew and sandwiches, mm-hmm. like, you know, just hot food. And these places are always packed, especially in winter, which, you know, winter is dark, it's long, it's cold. That's where people get yep. together to socialize. So you could have had something like that going on in IM Satsuna, like, you know, these really nice kind of soups and stews and stuff you could cook. It's a very small thing, but it, you know, going back to Odin Sphere, it adds a lot sure. of personality.
Or it's like the soup in Twilight Princess.
Oh, God, the soup was the best.
You immediately feel warm inside, right?
Yeah, because... even though the soup has, like, what are it, like, fish and pumpkins and cheese.
So when you're growing up, obviously in a super cold winter environment, you have a lot of very hot stews. And having a hot stew in the middle of winter is your own little slice of heaven, right?
Yeah, very much so.
If you permit me to rant, like, yes, you're right. Minnesota has a ton of coffee shops, especially in Minneapolis. Mm-hmm. And one of the nicest things is you walk into a place like On Common Grounds, and it gets cozy.
Exactly.
It gets cozy in a way that San Francisco does not.
Yes.
San Francisco has hip. It has Spartan. Mm-hmm. You're standing around. Like, there's not a lot of seating. You're meant to feel like you are lucky to be there, right?
Exactly.
Like, it's always packed to the gills. It's annoying. I don't like it.
Yeah.
Whereas you walk into a coffee shop in Minneapolis, and you see these big, cushy chairs mm-hmm. that you just want to huddle into with your big cup of hot chocolate or cafe mocha, which is amazing, mm-hmm. and just, I don't know, like, listen to music, work on a thing, look out the window and admire the snowy landscape, whatever.
But... yeah, exactly. It's the same with, like, Tim Hortons in Canada, except the Tim Hortons are always packed. Like, you can't get a seat no matter
what. Tim Hortons is like a McDonald's, though.
Oh, they're everywhere. I know. Like, my husband, when he came here to live, he laughed his ass off because he saw there was literally a Tim Hortons over here and Tim Hortons across the street, and they're both packed to the gills.
I mean, the Tim Hortons is like an unholy combination of Starbucks and McDonald's. I mean...
Oh, 100%. Good chili, though.
I wouldn't know because it has meat in it, so...
Oh, I'm sorry.
But to get back to the video game component, I think a winter setting can be really effective because mm-hmm. it puts you into a certain mindset, right?
Like, it really does.
It can contrast really nicely with, like, your indoor environments. Mm-hmm. They can be, like, your indoor environments just naturally pop a lot more. They look more, they're more colorful. They feel cozy. You can feel the coziness in your bones.
Yeah.
When you go out, the snow makes the landscapes really striking and that kind of thing. A game that uses its winter environment really effectively, of course, is Skyrim. Mm-hmm. Like, you associate those with, like, towering peaks, and, like, it does a really fantastic job of using its snow in a good way.
Like, yeah, one thing I really like about Skyrim is you go into, like, an inn, and it really does feel like, you know, an inn in a wintry land. You have, like, the big fire pit and the cauldron mm-hmm. of whatever bubbling over it, and the cheese mm-hmm. that you steal, and the yeah. idiot playing on the lute. Run, exactly. I should play her lute again.
So, I am Satsuna. The fact that I wasn't able to take advantage of that is disappointing.
It is.
And then, of course, you said, I am Satsuna's Spartan soundtrack is pretty, but the lack of variety is noticeable. I mean, it is like 95% piano yeah. compositions. We couldn't afford another instrument.
Pretty much. And I almost wonder if I would have preferred if it was... See, one thing about Breath of the Wild is the soundtrack is very... it splits a lot of people. Some people don't like how sparse it is, which I guess was Nintendo taking from Skyrim again. Whereas you only had music when you had kind of big events or, like, really imposing atmospheres. And I almost wonder if that would have worked better for I Am Satsuna, because just the silent, more quiet, you know, compositions for... the snowy environments and, like, you know, actually breaking out the piano in full swing for, like, when the situation really called for it, because something about the piano only victory theme really bothered the hell out of me. Hearing it over and over again, because of course it's a theme you hear over and over again, and there's nothing really all that victorious about a bonging piano. It sounds imposing.
Indeed.
Whereas, like, Final Fantasy is like da 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 da, you never forget that.
Nope. And then, of course, I am Setsuna's Magic Consortium and Sprite Knight?
I don't know if it's Sprite Knight or Sprit Knight. I call it Sprite Knight.
Invites a lot of direct comparisons, but you have a couple of problems with it.
Yeah, I found it stupidly complicated for what's ultimately something you don't use very much. I mean, you do, obviously, but I'm trying to remember exactly how it went. Like, you would beat enemies for, you know, like, vendor trash, and some of that you would sell back to the magic merchants to make the Sprite Knight, which you would re-equip. I don't know, it was just kind of, it wasn't like as simple as just leveling up with and learning a skill, which is what you would do in Chrono Trigger. And I can see that I Am Setsuna was trying to make itself a little, like, set itself a little bit apart from Chrono Trigger in some ways, but the ways that they chose, I don't think were very efficient.
Indeed. But as we're kind of seeing, it seems like the Lost Sphere takes the criticisms of I Am Setsuna a little bit to heart. For example, we heard different instruments in the trailer.
Yay!
Though, of course, that could just be for the trailer. They might have used up all their budget.
Yeah.
I don't want to be mean here. They're working on a really limited budget.
They really are.
Making games is expensive. Like, a indie can cost millions of dollars just by itself. Mm-hmm. The concept of someone just making a game out of their garage, like, it still exists, but
it's rare.
Like, the market is so flooded, and the bar has been raised so much for indie games that it is just, you can't really do the minimalism thing anymore.
Like, no.
It doesn't work very well.
Not unless you want to spend, like, 5 years. Like, I think that's what Stardew Valley took 5 years to make. And that was one guy.
I mean, that's what also happened to Cosmic Star Heroine, right? Like, they realized, on the one hand, we're screwed because we have to compete in this, like, really intense environment. But on the other hand, like, I mean, what they had to do to stand out, like, cost so much money mm-hmm. and so much time. Like, it was ridiculous, right?
Yeah, although one commenter argued that the story, you have to pay to get a good story. And I'm kind of on the fence about that one. That's something I'll probably write about at some point in the future. Because, yes, I do, I mean, hell, no one believes more than I do that writers should be paid their fair due, but I don't think you have to be brilliant to write a compelling story. I don't think you have to pay, like, a Hollywood writer. I think they could have made Ender from I Am Setsuna interesting. All they had to do was a few small things, and, again, I'm not asking for Shakespeare here. I'm just asking for someone I care about.
Indeed. All right. So with that, that is all the RPG news for this week. So now I'm going to have Mike Williams come on the show. He's going to talk about Elder Scrolls Online Morrowind.
Oh,
which,
boy.
It's a big MMO RPG type thing. And of course, Mike is into the MMO. So let's go talk to him. All right, with me now is Mike Williams, who has not been on the show in a while, but he is our MMO guy. He's going to be talking to us a little bit about Elder Scrolls Online Morrowind, which he's been playing. Mike, a lot of people have been saying that Elder Scrolls Online, after coming out and then kind of being ignored by a lot of people, is now finally kind of on the rise. So as a dedicated MMO fan, or at least a World of Warcraft fan, what's your take on that?
I agree with it wholeheartedly. I remember playing Elder Scrolls Online back when it first launched. I never had enough time for the expansions, but it like had some of the Elder Scrolls ideas, but it wasn't really, like, it didn't really feel like an Elder Scrolls game. It felt like an MMO with, like, a layer of Elder Scrolls on top of it. And they made a bunch of changes in the One Tamriel update. But I didn't play during that update, and so I'm jumping back in with Morrowind. And it feels very, very Elder Scrolls from a general presentation. The way the story is laid out, like, it really feels like they took Morrowind, like the original idea of Morrowind, and transplanted it into a newer Elder Scrolls engine. So as a fan of Morrowind, that's really cool.
Yeah, they're giving it a really hard push. in a way that I have simply not seen Elder Scrolls Online get pushed since launch. I can't even remember when Elder Scrolls Online came out. It was a few years ago. But yeah, they were holding like press events. Like they were like, they were putting it really front and center, which tells you that A, they really believed in the actual content, and B, they really want to kind of put Elder Scrolls Online back in the public eye in a way that it simply hasn't over the past few years. So here's what I'm like kind of wondering, like, first of all, like, what is Morrowind kind of like, how well does it kind of like realize Morrowind as a region? And the other thing is, like, MMORPGs as a genre, obviously, like, they had their heyday in like 2007, probably, like all the way through like 2011. And then, of course, like stuff like free to play, MOBAs, that kind of thing started to really take over. So like, how does it translate into kind of the current era where like MMORPGs are still have a dedicated fan base for sure, but aren't kind of the, you know, world destroying force that they were circa 2008?
Okay. So I would say that it translates Morrowind as a region fairly well, like seeing, Seda Neen, I believe is how you say it. The opening area, like literally you get off of the tutorial and you're right there at Seda Neen, which looks largely like, it's one of those weird things about nostalgia. You're always like, oh, I remember this the first time. And then you go back and look at it and you're like, oh, that it did not look that good. This looks, this looks like how I remember Morrowind mentally looking.
Yeah.
And the same is true when you finally get to Vivec City, where and they've taken like the basic idea and the architecture, like you can probably take screenshots side by side and look at it. And there's definitely more stuff being done, but the idea is still there, and it definitely feels like the original map and the original region of Morrowind. As far as I've gotten, I believe it's missing regions that were in the original Morrowind game, like stuff to the north. I don't think they're probably in the game at all. Perhaps that's more stuff that they'll add as additional content in this expansion. But for what they have there, it's a fairly good translation of Morrowind. Now, the underlying part of the game is still, as you said, like an MMO. So there are certain things that they have to tackle with that sort of undercut the original Morrowind feeling. But they're kind of things that you just sort of... Like, one, it's all voice dialogue, like recent Elder Scrolls games like Oblivion and like Skyrim. So the dialogue choices aren't necessarily as robust as they were back in Morrowind in the days. And that's always a problem that our Western RPG companies and even Japanese RPG companies have to deal with, in that text can... You can come up with a whole bunch of different dialogue tees with text that you can't really with voice. The other thing is they've, with Run Tamriel, they've overlaid a bunch of systems that make it feel more like Elder Scrolls. Like you can steal now and pickpocket and stuff. There's a sort of built-in justice system where if you get caught, the cities will put bounties on you, and then other players can hunt you. So it's kind of a, but it feels closer. But then there's like the leveling system. So in Skyrim and Oblivion, you know, if you want to level swords, you use a sword. If you want to level bows, you use a bow, magic. In this, there's hard levels. So you kill things, you gain XP, you gain a level on all the stuff that you do. So I'm not going to come out and say, hey guys, this is Morrowind 100% completely, like it's like going back in the day and playing it again. It's still an MMO, but it feels They've nailed the feel of Elder Scrolls very well this time around.
So here's the thing that I find kind of interesting with Morrowind is that, in my opinion, by picking Morrowind, they are really targeting the hardcore Elder Scrolls fan, because Morrowind, I think, really stands out in their memory, right? Like, I feel like Elder Scrolls was popular, but did not really become popularized. It did not become mainstream until Oblivion came around. And then subsequently Skyrim,
correct,
of course, like blew up, and Skyrim is still hideously popular. It's like insane how popular that game is. So I find it interesting that they are going back and appealing to hardcore Elder Scrolls fans in a game that, to my understanding, was already kind of for the hardcore Elder Scrolls fans anyway. So what I'm wondering is the general player population consisting more of hardcore Elder Scrolls fans, or more hardcore just like, I like RPGs and this is what I want to play? Or MMORPGs, I should say.
That is an interesting question to ask, and I'll be perfectly honest. So I'm the MMO guy here at US Gamer, as Kat has already said, but I'm also one of those people who, for the most part, in my experience, I will play solo.
Solo play.
Yes, no.
You're not in a guild or that kind of thing?
Not in Elder Scrolls. In WoW, I was fairly a raider, and in FF14, I hop in and out just because I don't have enough time between work.
Would you say you're more of a, are you a hardcore role player, or are you just enjoying grinding the content on your own?
I usually just enjoy grinding the content on my own, probably. So back in the day when I was hardcore raider into guilds and stuff like that, that was one thing. But when I fell out of that, the wave of MMO caught me again when they started adding things such as group finders, where I can just queue up and end up with the pug, which may go horribly, but I don't need to know these people. And if I don't like them, I don't need to see them again. Mm-hmm. But usually what ends up happening in the more popular games is I know editors at other outlets. So when I'm playing like WoW Legion, I'm playing with other reviewers from other, you know, outlets and past friends. Same with FF14. I don't actually have that with Elder Scrolls Online.
Interesting.
So
you're the only journo that you know who's playing it?
Yeah. It's
getting some coverage over at, you know, RPS and like PC Gamer and that kind of thing.
Yeah. I don't know those guys personally. Like, I read their stuff, I just don't know them personally. And the folks that I do know personally, are still playing, you know, FF14 said, like, this is not their game.
Who is it for? That's what I guess was kind of wondering, right? Like, who is it for?
I would say that lore wise it definitely leans heavily on veteran Elder Scrolls players. Like, there are definite characters and situations that are callbacks to previous things that you will not understand if you are a complete neophyte. Like, not that you won't, like, be able to get what's happening in the scene itself, but there's an extra layer of stuff. It's kind of like when, when I watch a Marvel movie or something, like, there's Easter eggs and stuff that most people will just, like, miss. Mm-hmm. And this feels the same. But at the same time, it does the MMO mechanics of it do a fairly straightforward job of just sort of easing the player in. Like, there's a very straightforward progression in play. So I honestly think to go back to your original question, they're aiming it at bringing back the Elder Scrolls hardcore, because why wouldn't you? Skyrim makes a ton of money, probably still to this day, and it has a very hardcore fan base, and of course you want to tap into those people. But I also think that it's a game that is perhaps, in my opinion, not as obtuse as the mainline Elder Scrolls games can be.
So if I'm an Elder Scrolls fan, but not an MMO fan, should I pick it up?
I would say you would enjoy yourself.
Interesting. Okay. How does it compare to like World of Warcraft and that kind of thing?
Oh, okay. So let me say one of the things, like I enjoyed the build of the world of Elder Scrolls games and the RPG elements. I've always hated the combat. It's not good to me. So when you compare it to like WoW or FF14, I feel the combat in those games is better. So, if I had to choose, this would not supplant my two mainstay games. But it's a good, what's the word I can use for this? It's a good Elder Scrolls travelogue. It's a very good Elder Scrolls travelogue. Like, it's just, hey, you jump into this, I'd probably do the critical path of this, and then I would be done with it until the next content edition.
Fair enough. Now, what have been your kind of favorite moments from the Morrowind expansion so far?
Honestly, revisiting old places. Going to Vivek City and meeting Vivek again in the throne room. He's just such a fun character. And you end up working directly for him. Like, he's like, hey, good to see you. You look pretty important. Would you like to do some stuff for a god? those are the moments that tend to stick out to me. Like when they revisit, and I honestly think that ZeniMax Online is building the game towards those moments being memorable to players. Like, you're like, hey, this is the first time I'm back here. I remember this place from the first time I played. And like I said, this is one of those things where if you're entering, say, Saedonin for the first time, it's one experience if you haven't played Morrowind before. But if you have played it before, it's almost like a homecoming. So it's not bad the other way. I just think that it's more meaningful.
So here's my problem with MMOs in general.
Right.
And the only MMO I've ever really truly been able to get into was Star Trek Online. And I think there's a reason for that. And the reason is that I spend most of the time in my ship, which I think is actually pretty rad, right? Whereas in a lot of MMOs, you are running through these hub towns, which are often beautifully realized, but full of people who are very clearly video game avatars, who are hopping around doing dumb things, just randomly appearing like out of thin air because they've just beamed in or something, who are like hanging around like a specific like hub area because they're going to sell some stuff. And that like totally takes me out of the game because it does not. Just, it looks wrong. It looks like a video game, right? Like, so the setting as a result, and often, like, in World of Warcraft, like, the scale is all wrong. Like, the characters look so strange next to the environment. Like, the environment looks really big, and the characters look small. And that always drove me completely nuts. And I understand that this is a really specific problem on my part, but it's really hurt immersion, and while I feel like MMORPGs in general have always been about being social, playing with your friends, going on a really cool raid, like the co-op gameplay element, I feel like they were originally built on the promise of being able to do a kind of inhabit this world that you find really interesting and things. Elder Scrolls certainly falls into that category. Knights of the Old Republic was another one. And I can't do it. Right? I can't do it because whenever I go into like Final Fantasy 14, I'm like, this game's beautiful. Oh, that person's totally hopping across. Like, what? Or these people are like dancing like idiots. Oh, okay, whatever. Like, this is an MMO, all right?
Okay. Yes. If that is your problem, you won't play.
It's a bugbear for me, Mike.
Yeah,
it's
because some games tend to do a lot of instance areas for story-related stuff. Elder Scrolls Online does not. So you will have regions where it is a deep, dank cave where, say, bandits or monsters are supposed to be, and you're the guy that's supposed to clear it out, but there's X number of other people also in that area running around clearing out monsters. So if the immersion factor is a problem, yeah, that the Elder Scrolls is not the game that fixes that. It is not the game that fixes that at all.
MMOs are so weird because, like, I feel like in some ways they've come a long way, but it's all been about, like, refining down the experience, the baseline experience that people already have. And I don't know. I think I'm looking for something different from a MMO. Maybe I should just play EVE Online or something. I don't know. But yeah. But Elder Scrolls Online, I guess, like, the thing that I will say about it is that it has a fan base. It has people who really enjoy it. And it certainly seems to have kind of come into its own a little bit in a way that it wasn't at launch. So, and it sounds like maybe it's something that if you're really into MMOs, you should check out.
Yeah, no, it's definitely sort of figured out what it wants to be. And that is an MMO that provides an Elder Scrolls-like experience. Very Elder Scrolls veneer. And taps heavily into that lore. But you are correct that a lot of MMOs have sort of been moving away from more complex. In fact, I just played today Secret World Legends, which is a revamp of the older Secret World, which was a very complex MMO. And this is a more simpler, streamlined, player-friendly experience. Yeah, there are games like EVE that have sort of held on to their complexity. But I always believe that generally, for the most part, MMO audiences trend downwards as people sort of fall away. So trying to rely on a specific hardcore niche of players is always hard. So I understand why developers do that. In approaching simplicity.
It's really the opposite of Blizzard because, I mean, yeah, Blizzard has its own established fan base, but they're all about casting the widest possible net, right?
Oh, God. WoW Legion, WoW for a while now has had something for everyone. Like, they have an entire... my significant other was playing and plays... Primarily, there's an entire, like, Pokemon-style pet capture game, like, inside of WoW. And for some people, that's all they do. Some people just play the auction house. Like they try to streamline the entrance into those specific experiences. But, yeah, certain games like WoW and FF14 that have been around for a while are games that you can never truly... experience the whole thing.
And that's like it's entirely its own community and everything,
right? PvP for as a look into my review process is always the last thing I do when I'm reviewing. I'm a single player, I'm a PvE guy, you know. I'll do the critical path of the story, level up to cap, dungeons, do any raids if I can. And then, like, PvP is like, oh, at the end, I was like, oh, I got to play PvP, though. So.
All right, Mike, final thoughts on Elder Scrolls Online Morrowind.
If you are a Morrowind fan, as I, and you're willing to look over some of the MMO elements that bother, say, like, Cat with the immersion, it is worth trying out. Is worth trying out, at least. I think it will tug on those nostalgic heartstrings.
All right, fair enough. Mike, we can check out your review over on the site, US Gamer. And in the meantime, we'll see you at E3. So looking forward to it. And thanks for a lot. We'll be heading over to back to Nadia for some quick reader comments. So don't go away. Okay, I'm back here with Nadia now, and Nadia, we're going to do what we usually do, which is the reader comments.
Oh, that's my favorite part.
Oh, yeah, it's absolutely. First one is from Rider Kicker. When I played Chrono Trigger the first time, I went through the Black Omen in 3 time periods just to farm Mega Elixirs. I know there could have been more efficient means, but whatevs. Wow, okay, jeez. 3 time periods just to farm Mega Elixirs.
I'm trying to remember how to get Mega Elixirs. I think you get them from these, they're like these two-headed snake enemies in the, I don't know if you've been in the Black Omen yet, have you?
Or
you
haven't? I have not, no.
Okay, well, there's these two-headed snake enemies that you can charm them, you can get, charm the Mega Elixirs out of, so... Yeah, that's the thing you could do, I guess. Have fun with that.
Speaking of Chrono Trigger, I had a friend of mine request, basically. He said, please beat the game without Chrono. Because he said that he's never had a friend who beat it without Chrono first, and he wants to see how I feel about that. How do you think I should do it?
I'm trying to remember what happens, but I don't know what your level is. I mean, Lavos is not an easy dude to go up against, and I mean...
Late like, 30s?
That shouldn't be too bad, I guess.
Yeah.
There are a whole bunch of endings in that game, and, like, even just doing subtle things can change it. Like, I was going to say, okay, if you just smash the Epoch into him, you'll skip part of the battle, but then that might change the ending, so I don't know. Yeah, you may as well try. I don't see the harm in that.
All right, I'll do that.
I will say, though, that
means
one of my...
I'm going to miss out on some of the side quests, probably.
Well, you can still go back and do though.
I suppose I can I?
Yeah, and I can't remember if you can do like some or all of the side quests without Chrono. One thing I was going to say to you though is one of my favorite endings in the game is you finish the game, Chrono's alive, and you smash the Epoch into Lavos, and that affects the ending.
Spoiler alert. I mean, I knew that you could smash the Epoch into Lavos, so...
Go to a party like it's 1999 and see what happens.
All right, Nuclear Vomit says, do you remember that I was telling the whole story about my Shadowrun DM with the dog and everything?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Poor dog.
He said, Kat, you should have told that frag face of a Shadowrun DM to slot off. Goes out without saying that anyone would have leave food and water for their dog. Why didn't the DM ask if you or any other party member forgot to put on underwear? Did your character forget to stop breathing while you took a whiskey sour? Well, your character chokes as it goes down the wrong pipe.
I could see a really satanic DM doing that.
I took a screen cap of that comment, by the way, and sent it to the DM, and he's like, oh, great, backseat DMing, good.
Just what I need.
I wasn't expecting to be, like, have my DMing critiqued in a freaking comment on the internet at random.
That's
but
great.
He let me keep the dog alive, so I don't begrudge him that. It ended up being a funny story, right?
Somehow I'm reminded of, have you ever seen that Jack Chick track, Dark Dungeons, where it's like one of his most infamous works. It's like a whole Dungeons and Dragons satanic scare
track. Right, that one, yeah.
Yeah, and you have this like really like sort of voluptuous DM named Mrs. Frost, or Miss Frost. Like she immediately kills off the thief character, Blackleaf. Like, she just proclaims him dead. And, of course, the person controlling Blackleaf is freaking out. But every nerd who read that comic, that tract, is like, well, why didn't they just do a saving throw? How could you just kill off a character like that? You can't do that.
Actually, they could do a saving throw, Ms.
Exactly.
Dawn of Satan. So, I don't even know what you're talking about.
So, if there is a Satan, I would assume he knows how to play D&D.
I really hope Jack Trick got fired for that. Anyway, Lord Bob Bree says, cool, another Gao fan. I really like using him when I play. He takes some work to get his good rages, but he has a lot of variety available. I still hope his concept gets reused in the future, maybe with improvements.
Yeah, I enjoyed Gao. I mean, to be honest, once I Final Fantasy VI is one of those games I've played too many times to count, and in my later playthroughs, like these days, if I play through the game now, I would not sit there and find the frickin' monsters I need for Gao, because when I was a kid, I'd play the game, and I was, like, determined to play it only one way. I'd sit there for hours trying to get, like, the right rages for Gao, and I just don't have that kind of time anymore.
All right, and finally, our kind of email of the week is from Josh Anderson. He says, Kat and Nadia really enjoyed this past week's show, especially the discussion about Dragon's Dogma. Personally, I found it to be very enjoyable, and the ending in particular makes me think it would be an excellent Nadia game, trademark. For most of Dragon's Dogma, the story can be charitably described as slight, but the ending pulls a wonderful trick of taking an aspect of the gameplay that might not even have been paying that much attention to and making it the central focus. If you're the kind of person who enjoys fan fiction, hint, hint, or you got really into that dashing shark man in Zelda, basically, if you're the kind of person who likes to fill in the blanks of a story with your own imagination, then the ending of Dragon's Dogma is one of the most fulfilling and surprisingly touching sequences I've experienced in a game.
Oh, that's intriguing.
There you go, Nadia. This is your next game trademark.
I'm glad I have a trademark. That really makes me happy. I didn't file it.
People people know what you like, Nadia.
Yeah, that's nice.
You have very specific tastes.
Yeah, no kidding. Although I don't know if I was kind of into Sidon, Prince Sidon. He was all right. He's cute. I'd hug him. I'd definitely hug him.
And by the way, I mentioned that there was that crazy song, but I felt like I was going crazy because I couldn't find it in the OST. Mm. It was in the vanilla version. People on Twitter tell me that I was not crazy.
Oh, okay. Good job.
Yes, good job, me.
You are so sane. There was one story I've told in the past, very quickly. I did once think I was going insane because of a video game, and that was I was walking home from school. And cutting through my family's house, backed out into a hockey rink parking lot, of course. And I was walking through this as usual, and I start hearing the Zelda theme playing in my head. And I'm looking around everywhere in the middle of a parking lot, so I'm like, "Where the hell is this coming from?" And I'm like, "Oh, that's it. I've totally lost it. I'm hearing the Zelda theme in my head for no freaking reason." It turns out I had my Game Boy in my backpack, and it had turned on, and I had Link's Awakening, and it was playing the title screen over and over again. So I wasn't going insane. And that was a very good day.
See, I might have thought I was going crazy because of the Mandela effect. Have you heard of this thing?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, where people posit that once the Large Hadron Collider turned on, it destroyed the universe and put us into an alternate universe.
Yes.
Where the Berenstain Bears became the Berenstain Bears.
Yeah, but they were always the Berenstain Bears.
And apparently people remember Nelson Mandela dying in prison, which is crazy because he was actually the president of South Africa. But I digress. There's a whole movie about it. So in that sense, maybe like Dragon's Dogma might have had a JRPG or J-pop track in the original universe, but in the new universe, it did not.
Ooh.
Makes you think, didn't it? But no, Twitter told me that the Mandela effect does not apply to Dragon's Dogma.
We are still in Universe A.
And on that note, Axe of Blood God is a US Gamer podcast. You can find us on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever podcasts are sold. By the way, could you guys do me a favor? Could you guys go and review us over on Stitcher? So we've only got a couple reviews over there right now, and as a result, we are not listed, actually, on Stitcher.
Oh, my God.
And I would really appreciate it if you guys could drop a couple of reviews over there, especially if you like the show. We always like hearing feedback from you guys, because you guys are the best. So
you are. Thank you.
Yes. Please do us a favor and do that. In the meantime, you can follow us all over the place on social media, Facebook, Twitter, the whole nine yards. We've been updating our Twitter and Facebook quite a lot. We've been having a lot of fun with it, I think. You can follow me on Twitter at @_catbot. You can follow Nadia at Nadia Oxford or read her blog, Tiny Girl, Tiny Games. And you should check out Twitter, US Gamer's official Twitter account, US GamerNet. Also, Mike streams on Fridays now.
He does, yes. He does quite a good job, too.
Yes, he streams around 4 p.m., Eastern, which is 1 p.m. Pacific, and you can follow that at twitch.tv/USGamerNet, and maybe we'll be doing some more streaming and that kind of thing after E3 is all finished.
Mm-hmm.
In the meantime, oh my god, E3 is coming right up. It is just around the corner.
I think I'm still in denial.
I am totally in denial. Like, I've been going, oh crap, I got like a week and a half to go.
I better do something about this. Yeah.
I got everything scheduled. I'm kind of putting the last touches on everything to get to for the actual show, but I'm just like kind of like breathing heavily because, oh my gosh, E3 is like
heavy breathing.
By the end of E3 week, I am always so burned out that I'm just like I can't even deal anymore because like it's a solid week.
It is
a solid week of just running around, drinking, attending shows, taking events, writing as fast as you possibly can, trying to balance work with like networking. It is crazy. But at the same time, you see everybody, you see all your friends and everything. The thing that's going to be even crazier about this year is that actual people will be there. I hate actual people.
Actual people suck.
They allowed the plebs in.
There was I went for the 2006 show, and I was there when they let in the crowd to see the Wii, and it was just a stampede, like literal boom, 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 boom. It was pretty great.
I went to TGS in 2006 hoping to see a Wii, not realizing that Nintendo was not somebody that was showing at TGS back then.
Oh, wow.
And I was real mad when the Wii, like, was not really available to play. Though, it was kind of around, you could play Sonic 06 on it.
Oh, boy.
But it was hands-off only.
Really?
And you could see people demonstrating it, but you could not actually play it. Which was hella frustrating. You could play the PS3, though, and all of the crappy, crappy launch games that were coming out for it.
That was pretty bad, I remember
Which
that.
I totally did. Yep, that was a PS3 thing that happened. All right, so we'll be back next week, as always, and perhaps we will have finished up Chrono Trigger and Persona 4 Golden just in time for E3, so please look forward to that. In the meantime, for Nadia and myself, and of course Mike, thanks for listening. We'll be back once again, as always. Until then, happy adventuring.